Our topic for tonight is Leo Pinsker and auto-emancipation. Okay, so up until now, we've discussed the forerunners of Zionism, Rabbis Alkali and Kalischer, among the traditional types, and Moses Hess, who was a communist, an agnostic, a Spinozist, among the secular sort. And tonight we're going to discuss the year that changed everything, 1881, when Eastern European Jewry was turned up on its head, and people start moving in all sorts of directions, but mostly to America, with Israel being an afterthought for most, but the primary destination for a limited few, and what the ideology was behind that move. So, in the spring of 1881, Tsar Alexander II of Russia was assassinated. Who assassinated him? A band of anarchists, among whom there was a Jew or two in a cabal of about 12 people, but it's always easy to blame the Jews for these sorts of things. And his successor, Alexander III, offered no concessions whatsoever towards liberalism and wanted to crack down hard on those elements of the population that were detested, notably the Jews. Now, the Barefoot Army was a bunch of hyper-nationalist types who were roaming about the country looking for scapegoats. And the regime was looking to channel that rage away from themselves. I mean, the Tsar was just assassinated. The last thing you want if you're a government bureaucrat is to be the next one on the hit list. So you want the angry mob of Russian peasants to take out their ire on someone other than yourself. The Jews are a convenient target for peasant hostility. And pogroms would last from the spring, from April of 1881, really all the way until the summer of 1884. This was about a 3.5-year stretch where it was dangerous. In Poland and Lithuania, the communities were largely untouched. There was a pogrom in Warsaw, but other than that, in Congress Poland and to the north in Lithuania, there was really nothing going on. Where was the action? In the southern Pale of Settlement, which is why the Maskilim referred to the pogroms as Sufot Banegev, which means what? Storms in the Negev, in the south of Russia. That it emanated from southern Russia, from Odessa, from points just to the north of Odessa, and then went further north. But never made it all the way to Lita or to the classic communities of the Northern Pale. Well, there is a major historical question as to whether the central government in St. Petersburg was orchestrating these pogroms from their headquarters, or it just sort of happened on its own with the acquiescence of local officials. Well, like the Intifada. So, I mean, in the case of the Intifada, the first Intifada really was a local thing, and then the PLO grabbed it after it started. In the second Intifada, the PLO really was responsible from the beginning. But in the case of the pogroms of 1881 to 1884, it's an open question. There really is no strong evidence to say that the central government in Russia were dictating terms. It was that there's an angry mob, and the government can choose to suppress that angry mob with a heavy hand, and in some places they did, or to give them room to do their dirty work, which in other places they did. And who are the victims? The Jews. Well, how deadly were these pogroms? Very? Not so? What do you think?
I think they were deadly because my grandmother came to the United States at that time, and she could never assimilate.
Uh-huh. Okay, so my great-grandmother, all right, Grandma Fanny, used to say that she was hiding under the bed in Bialystok when the Cossacks came roaring in.
Did the Golden Mayor have that sense?
Yes, she did. She did, absolutely. So it was a dangerous time, but let's be very clear about the nature of the casualties. There were never more than a handful of deaths in any one pogrom, and the total number over the 3 years was not more than a few hundred, which is a lot, not compared to the carnage of after World War I in the Red-White Civil War in Russia, where 250,000 Jews got killed, or for that matter, the Shoah, with the 6 million, 60 years later, in the 1940s, but a few hundred is a very large number when you compare it with basically zero in the century prior. That the Pale of Settlement, although it was never a good place for the Jews, it was not a dangerous place necessarily for the Jews. From the demise of the Polish state and the partition of Poland and the Russian takeover of large swaths of Jewish, heavily Jewish territory, until 1881, people weren't getting killed. There was anti-Semitic legislation, there were the choppers who were grabbing kids into the army, but brutal violence and rape and pillaging, for the most part, didn't happen. So this is a shock to the system. It really catches them off guard. And people don't like it. and they want to leave. Well, who wants to leave? So there are two factors that kept Jews in the Pale of Settlement for the first 100 years of its existence, up until 1881. One is religious orthodoxy, meaning you have to live where the pious Jews live, and the pious Jews are in the Pale of Settlement, in the Shtetlach, and for that matter in the towns, and to go elsewhere means to expose yourself to the danger of losing your religion in a place which is barren of Yiddishkeit. And there's also an issue of immobilism. The Jews feel as though they are stranded and that ideologically they're supposed to be stranded. This has nothing to do with the observance of Shabbos or Kashrus or anything like that, where you need a community to be frum. This is more that Jews regarded themselves as with a fatalistic attitude, that it is our goral, it is our destiny to be stuck in an unpleasant diaspora where bad things occasionally happen, and it doesn't mean we run away from them. We just sort of absorb the punishment and try to keep living. But the end result is you don't actually change your location from point A to point B, you stay where you were. Well, if you're a traditionalist, then the orthodoxy and the immobilism is going to keep you where you were. But let's say you're a halfway assimilated Jew, and there were plenty of such people by the 1880s, or for that matter, you're a totally assimilated Jew, then these sentiments are not going to keep you in one place. You're going to be ready to move if you think your life is in danger. Now, that said, we have to distinguish between very acculturated people and not so acculturated people. The very acculturated people were likely to not even be living in the Pale of Settlement. Where were they living? In real Russia, not Jewish Russia, real Goyisha Russia, like St. Petersburg, Moscow, the big cities, because they had a right to go out of the Pale into the Russian interior on the basis of having been a military veteran, a university graduate, a doctor, whatever it is, a railroad magnate, a sugar magnate, a timber magnate, you know, you were a boss of some kind of a industry. So if that was your lot in life, and you spoke Russian, and probably weren't so religious anymore, then you lived not in the heartland of Russian Jewry. So if that was your case, then geographically you were quite distant from the pogroms, and even psychologically you were totally removed from the fate of your brethren who were still poor and in the Pale. So those people didn't want to move. They stayed where they were in the big Russian cities. Who was most likely to move? Someone who was not a pious observer necessarily. They had some degree of acculturation, but not all that much, and they still lived in the shtetlach or in the Pale, you know, of the Pale, and they see violence and they say to themselves, I got to get out of here, and I'm willing to get out of here. So where do you go? The answer is you go to Brody. Where's Brody? It's on the border in Austria-Hungary. It's southern Galicia, and that's a border town where there's a refugee camp, and you can get some aid from the Allianz and from other charitable organizations, and try to move on your way further west. Where are you going to go? Well, maybe Germany, maybe France, maybe England, maybe the United States, and as time would progress, more and more with the United States rather than continental Europe. So people are on the move. How many? A few thousand. Then 10,000, then 20,000. In the first year, it was assumed that there would be about a cap of 100,000. 100,000 Jews would leave, and then things would simmer down. What actually happened is over the next 33 years, 3 million Jews leave, including 2.5 million who go to Ellis Island and make it to America. But in the beginning, it was not assumed that the vast bulk or a significant portion of Russian Jewry was going to escape. We just thought a little trickle will go out, and that trickle was getting bigger and bigger, and it scared the philanthropists. We don't know what to do with these people. Okay. Not always. So in the beginning, it was illegal to leave Russia. Then, I think about 1883, they no longer, 1884, they no longer imposed any restrictions on the border in terms of leaving. Whether you could get into another country was a separate matter, but there was nothing stopping you from leaving. The border was then open, which was a change from prior policy. Okay, well, they're going to go to the uncles in Chicago will be neighbors. Yeah.
Did anybody go to the other side,
to Ukraine? So, the Ukraine was a dangerous place. Because that's the Sufot Banegev are really in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
That's what today's Ukraine and Belarus was the heartland of the Pale, aside from the Congress Poland and Lithuania further to the north. So that's what people wanted to get out of, not to stay there. Well, in 1882. So the Tsarist Empire was religiously anti-Judaic. The Tsar, Nicholas II, Alexander III, then Nicholas II, his son, was quoted as saying, when there was a thought that if we liberalize the policy against the Jews, maybe we could solve our Jewish problem, our Jewish question, that with a more relaxed attitude towards them, they'll blend into society. They will no longer be this odd, you know, anomaly that engage only in petty trading and money lending, but rather they'll be people of the land like everybody else, and they'll assimilate, they'll become Gentiles. You know, liberalism will solve our problem of the Jews. And the Tsar supposedly said, but how could we relax the law against them? They killed Jesus and spilled every drop of his priceless blood. Priceless blood.
Why was the Ukraine the center?
Oh, because... Well, they were very backward. They didn't like Jews. There was competition. And we're going to see that Pinsker, who I'm going to discuss tonight, and Lilienblum, they address why the local population was getting more and more antagonistic towards Jews over economic matters. Economic matters, yeah.
Yeah, in this week's electronic tablet magazine, uh-huh. I commented on that. The psychological factor of envy is something that we overlook, but it's there.
It was a big deal. It was a very big deal because Jews were doing, although they were not doing well, neither were the serfs who had been recently emancipated.
Yeah.
And so when there's competition between the native son and the person who is regarded as the stranger, then, as Lilienblum, we will discuss in a minute, said, when the guest has eaten, it's intolerable to the native son who's hungry.
Right.
When the native son is, his belly is rumbling, and he sees that the guest, the stranger, the Jew, who is really not of us, has his belly full, there's going to be some anger felt and some violence in the streets. Okay. So,
I also think it was the church
that... Well, absolutely. The Russian Orthodox Church is horribly anti-Semitic and never reformed itself. Never. Okay, so... In 1882, in May, temporary edicts were issued by the government, which became known as the May Laws. The May Laws restricted Jewish ability to reside in the countryside, to lease farmland, and to live outside of the towns, also to live near the border. There was like a 50-mile no-go zone. Also, there were restrictions of the sale of liquor, which is a big deal because many Jews earn their livelihood by the sale of liquor. So all this was to make Jewish life in the Pale impossible, with the theory being that a third will convert to Orthodox Russian Orthodoxy, a third will leave, and a third will die, and there'll be no more Jews. We'll make life so horrible that there can't be any more Jews here in Russia. So the philanthropists recognize that they have a role to play, and I mean not the Russian Jewish philanthropists who live in St. Petersburg, like Baron Ginsburg, who said, don't move, but rather the French Jewish philanthropists and the British Jewish philanthropists and the Americans, they said, okay, we're going to have to help people get to a new place. But that place is not going to be Eretz Yisrael.
Who are these people?
So the answer to that is, in France, these are the members of the Alliance. In England, it's the Board of Deputies of British Jews. In America, it's the B'nai B'rith, and later... The American Jewish Committee, and after that the JDC, but that's much later. That's after World War I. So there are organizations in all the Western countries that where wealthy Jews get together for righteous purposes of helping their brethren who are elsewhere. But what guidance are they offering them? Well, the one consensus is don't go to Israel. Why don't go to Israel? For a variety of reasons. Number one. Well, you'd have to be farmers. You guys don't know how to be farmers. You have no history of living on the land. You'll starve. Secondly, there's hardly any fertile land available for purchase. Thirdly, the Turks are not really friendly towards us and are not interested in you arriving there to begin with. Fourthly, the Bedouin are dangerous and they'll attack you at night and kill you. So it's all a problem. Any Jew who goes to Israel will find themselves horribly impoverished and relying upon charity no better than the chalukah of the old yeshuv. So all the philanthropists say, we can't stop you from going there, but we're not going to pay your way there. It's a silly idea. All right. Well, what ends up happening is that lovers of Zion organizations spontaneously and simultaneously develop in hundreds of locales in Russia and in Romania. Chomavet Zion, not necessarily by that name, by a wide range of names. Some were called Ezra, some were called Nehemiah, some were called Zerubbabel, some were called Zion, whatever it is, a name that evoked a return to Zion, with Ezra, Nehemiah, and Zerubbabel being from the Second Temple times, or after the Babylonian captivity. Well, these groups were all local groups. They were not united in purpose. They may have had similar purposes, but they were not united. And it was difficult to create that unity because Russia had no organized community. Remember, after the Council of the Four Lands, the Avad Arba Artsot, was abolished in the year 1764, there was no supranational entity for Ashkenazic Jewry. It didn't exist. There's no chief rabbi, there's no board of deputies, there's nothing. So that's one problem. Also, it's difficult to organize even a new organization because of the Russian censor. They're reading the mail, and the Tsar is not interested in having Jewish nationalism sprout forth on his soil. So letters had to be written in an elliptical style, where you use pseudonyms and code names and acronyms. You couldn't speak freely, even in letters. What played an important role was the Jewish periodical press. There were Russian Jewish newspapers, and there were Hebrew language papers, and there was even at the beginnings of a Yiddish paper. Okay, so this was a way of getting information out about, first of all, about pogroms, and even that had to be dealt with delicately because the government was not interested in people knowing about killing. They didn't want the outside world to know killings were going on, and they didn't want Jews to get all nervous and hyper. So this information was suppressed as well, aside from nationalist sentiment. Okay, so there's no organized group that is more than just one city at a time. Each one is very local. But still, even the local groups are able to accomplish important things. And three categories of people went to Eretz Yisrael between 1882 and 1884 from Eastern Europe, from the Eastern European Ashkenazic Jewry. The first group is by far the most famous. Beginning with a student association in Kharkov, they established a group called Daber El Bnei Yisrael Ve Yisau. Okay, speak to the children of Israel and let them go. All right, Moses, God says to Moses, Daber El Bnei Yisrael Ve Yisau, by the splitting of the sea. Now, this group later changed its name to Beit Yaakov Lechu Ve Neelcha, which stands for, Bilu. Now, they left out the rest of that pasuk. What's the rest of that pasuk? Be'or Hashem, in the light of God. So they were very secular, at least some of them were. So they left out Be'or Hashem. It's just Beit Yaakov Lechu Ve Neelcha, come and go. All right. What happened to these people? A group of 14 of them, unskilled would-be farmers, went to Constantinople and then took a boat ride to Jaffa, where they weren't even sure they were going to be allowed in the country because they didn't have valid papers to enter the country, but they were somehow allowed in. And they didn't know what they were going to do. They just know they wanted to work the land. So temporarily, they went to Mikveh Israel, the agricultural school, which was established in 1870 by the fancy rich French Jews. And they worked there as employees. They're highly ideological. Over the next 2 years, about 50 to 60 of them would show up, but only 20 remained by late 1884. There was a high rate of attrition. It was not easy to be a bilunik, okay? Life was tough. You lived hand to mouth, you had nothing. And you weren't supposed to get married, and everything was communal property. It really was a hard life. And some of them died of malaria. Not easy. So, but in 1884, they founded Gedera, which Arayom Hazeh still exists. So that was their one lasting contribution. So primarily their contribution was in the moral and ideological realm, not so much the practical realm. They naively believed that the Ottoman Sultan would issue a firman, which is like a charter of some kind, to let you have a some pseudo-autonomy on a plot of land in the country. That never happened. They also never thought about relations with the Arabs. They were totally oblivious to the Arab question, and in that regard, they prefigure a lot of Zionist personalities for the next 60 years. They were influenced by the Russian movement of back to the people, back to the land, which was essentially a middle-class group that wanted to eschew their middle-class upbringing and become peasants, going from being non-peasants to being peasants. It's an odd thing to want to do, but in its time and place, it served a purpose. Okay, that was the first group. The second group were a bunch of Romanian Jews. Now, Romania is truly given its independence in about 1878 after the Congress of Berlin, and Romania is the most anti-Semitic country on earth, at least politically speaking. I'm not saying that Jews had it worse there than anywhere else in terms of physical violence, but in terms of the law on the books and government policy, Romania was the worst country in the world for Jews. And even foreign Jews were considered Jews. What does that mean? If you're an American citizen and you go to Romania on business in 1879, you're not an American citizen, you're a Jew. And the disabilities that are imposed on the local Jews are also imposed on you. Now that,
what were the laws?
Inability to own certain types of property, inability to be entering certain professions, certainly not entering any government civil service. There were severe restrictions on rights of residence and employment opportunities, and also eventually expulsion of certain people from the country. So Romanian Jews got together at Fukshani. Yeah. The identity cards had said Jew on it, yes, in red ink.
Only in recent years in the European Union that
they're not allowed to do it anymore, right. So the Jews got together, 32 Jews got together in Fukshani on December 30th, 1881, to discuss the possibility of a group moving to Eretz Yisrael. Unlike Bilu, these were not ideologically driven people, or people who were going to indulge in theoretical speculation at a gathering. They were down to earth, very practical. They wanted to get things done. And they did. In August of 1882, 228 Romanian Jews, families, not just unmarried teenagers and 20-somethings, but families, a real substantial group, made their way to Eretz Yisrael and established Zichron Yaakov, which still exists to this day, and there's good ice cream there. Okay, so around that time, there was a British character by the name of Lawrence Oliphant who was espousing the Jewish return to Eretz Yisrael. Yes, he was a quirky Christian Zionist type out of England, but also it was for political reasons that he wanted to build up a Jewish presence in Eretz Yisrael to help Turkey against Russia. It was an odd political calculation that didn't really make much sense. He was thought of when he went to Eastern Europe as a second Cyrus, as his Koresh, Melech Paras, okay, that this guy is a British noble and he's going to help us go back to Eretz Yisrael. He got the Jews' hopes very high in Romania and southern Russia in 1879 through 1881, but he actually did more damage than he did good, because by getting hopes up and going to Constantinople, he called attention to the issue of Zionism. And that attention was captured by the Ottoman Sultan, who now knows that the Jews are up to some funny business trying to sneak into the country in significant numbers, and so he puts the kibosh on it and forbids any further entry. So Oliphant meant to be Philo-Semitic, but in the end he actually didn't accomplish too much for the Jews. Now the third group who want to go to Israel are from Russia. Again, they're non-ideological, unlike Bilu. They're led by Zalman David Levantin, and they established Rishon LeZion in 1882. By 1890, there were 8 Jewish villages in Eretz Yisrael, in which the population was about 2,400. Now, that's not very much. 2,400, after about a decade of Chibat Zion work, of Lovers of Zion work, it's not much. But then again, the task was very difficult, and the money just wasn't there. Philanthropic support wasn't there. Okay, the Yishuv HaYashan was in Jerusalem, was in Hebron, was in Sfat, was in Tveria, was in Jaffa, and so the thing is this. It's important to know that there isn't a clear divide between the Yishuv HaYashan and the Yishuv HaKadash. Yes, we can point to Jewish farming villages which are brand new from new arrivals who have Zionistic motivation. However, there are other types of Jews who are in Eretz Yisrael who may have begun their careers in the Yishuv HaYashan, but slowly gravitate away from it and towards the Chadash. So, for example, in 1881, about 500 Yemenite Jews moved to Israel, which gave the first Aliyah something of an ecumenical character. It wasn't just Russian, it was also Romanian, also Yemenite. And where do they go? They go instinctively to the religious enclaves, to the old Yishuv. But they also are not really like the old Yishuv in the sense that they want to work the land, and they do handicraft. So they escape those limited confines and branch out. Also, there are people who were living in the old city of Jerusalem who move beyond the old city. Yes, Me'ah Sharim, when it's established, is certainly not Yishuv HaKadash. It's still very much Yishuv HaYashan. But anyone who's willing to venture beyond their comfort zone might later break away completely from that mold and become another Jew of Eretz Yisrael, not part of that old world of non-productive, charity-grabbing Yashan types. Okay, so there's no clear distinction. Right, now.
Yeah, but they were there when nobody else was.
Oh, sure. Well, there were Gentiles there. There were a bunch of Arabs, and there were Europeans who were protected by the consulates. Okay, so the Turkish policy was to restrict immigration, and this attitude of the Turks dissuaded people even from making the attempt to go to Eretz Israel, because nobody wanted to be stuck bouncing from harbor to harbor on a rickety ship like the Jews of 1939. That in 1881, 82, 83, either you're going to get in or you're not going to go. And so Turkish policy really did dissuade many people who might have gone to Eretz Israel. So let's now discuss Leo Pinsker, our main topic for tonight, and auto-emancipation. Emigration to the West required no leaders, no institutions, and no ideology. I'm a head of a family in the shtetl, and I saw the Cossacks coming. I take my kids and the spouse, and I run. I don't need a leader. I don't need an ideology. We just go. We just go. Eretz Yisrael, however, only makes sense if your goal is to radically change the conditions of the Jewish people, and then secondarily the condition of the individual Jew. If your primary concern is the fate of Klal Yisrael, then you'll go to Eretz Yisrael. If you're concerned about the Yachid, the individual, yourself, you'll go to where it's comfortable.
You know, so I know so many people who went to Eretz Yisrael because it was expedient and ended up being here than anybody else. You understand what I'm saying?
Say this again.
Yeah, so it sounded like they were going to do, but ultimately ended up being about themselves.
Okay, so many people did go to Eretz Yisrael and found it very difficult, whether in the 1880s, right, the 1890s, the 1900s, the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s and 60s and 70s, and eventually left. Eretz Yisrael was not easy until it became a first world country under Bibi 20 years ago.
Place to go.
What was that?
It was the most expedient place to
go. Well, that was true between 1949 and, sometime later, a few years later, when getting into a Western country wasn't such a simple thing, but you could guarantee yourself entry into the State of Israel. Before that, I'll tell you when it was more expedient. In between 1933 and 1937 or 38, getting into Eretz Yisrael was easier than getting into America. So if you were a German Jew who doesn't like the Nazi takeover, and before the Nuremberg Laws, or before Kristallnacht, and you weren't even a big Zionist, but you could tolerate Eretz Yisrael, so you went, and all of a sudden you were living in Tel Aviv because you couldn't get into New York or Philadelphia. Okay, yeah.
Didn't the steamship companies help finance people because they need workers?
The tickets to the West were relatively inexpensive. But if you had a large family, even an inexpensive ticket became a major proposition, which is why people went, a few people at a time, not whole families together. Okay, let's get to Pinsker. So, the idea of going to Eretz Yisrael is on people's mind. Most are rejecting it, but some like the idea. And in Russia, there were Jews who were maskilim, who were enlightened figures, who in an earlier time would have encouraged Russification and education as the solution to the Jewish problem. Learn Russian, get an education, become a professional, become a member of society, break away from the old line Jewish community. Well, Moshe Leib Lilienblum was a man of this sort. He was born in 1843. Okay, he's a Eloi, he's a Talmud scholar, as a youth. He breaks away over time. In 1869, he's already out of the Orthodox world. He moves to Odessa, and he believes in Russification and education. But then he recognizes, you know what? The errors of Israel and the brutalities of the Goyim are all bad. Meaning the Jews don't do the right thing and the Goyim don't do the right thing. It's all horrible. What's the solution? Eretz Yisrael. Our own place, our own sovereignty. And he focuses on the issue of livelihood. That the Jew is a foreigner and is barely tolerable to the local population. And if we're doing well materially, they're going to be jealous of us and they're going to want to kill us. So if we want to avoid being devastated with some sort of a Holocaust, we have to get out and go to where we are the majority. Surgery. Go to Eretz Yisrael. And he says America is not the answer because we'll be strangers there too. That if Jews went in too large of a number to America, the Russian problem would become an American problem. Okay? That's his idea. Now, Lilienblum's most important contribution ideologically, however, was this. He said there's a big machlokes between the Orthodox and the non-Orthodox, between the traditionalists and the free thinkers, and he's a free thinker. And he says, you know, we fought for a few decades now, but we have to be willing to bury the hatchet and stop fighting over it, because Jewish survival is more important than the petty religious issues over which we're fighting. So we're not going to resolve the religious issues. They'll remain a matter of dispute. But we need to nonetheless come together in a nationalistic cause, otherwise we're all dead. That was Lilienblum's great contribution, because the Zionist movement would, from the days of Herzl and all the way to the establishment of the State of Israel, be a movement that included people of all religious stripes. Yes, the fervently Orthodox Haredi world would largely be opposed, but within Zionism, you had people of wide-ranging religious viewpoints. Okay, now, he was one character. Then we get to Leo Pinsker. Leo Pinsker was born in 1821, so he's older than Lilienblum by a good 20 years, and he was born into a middle-class family, not especially religious at all. He was really estranged from Judaism. He's a maskil from his early youth. And he goes to law school. He can't get a job as a lawyer. He becomes a physician. He becomes a very prominent physician in Odessa. And he's a member of the Society for the Promotion of Culture Among the Jews, which was a St. Petersburg-based organization led by the Günzburg family, the rich people, where they're trying to spread enlightenment and university education among the Jews of the shtetl, because that's the solution to all of life's problems. Well, the 1881 pogrom shattered his idea of Russification. And he goes to the society meeting after the first pogrom, and he says, you guys are fighting over nonsense. You're issuing scholarships to this kid to go to the University of Berlin, or this kid to go to the University of Vienna, whatever. You're doling out a pittance of money for the education of random Chaim Yankels in the shtetl, but that's not going to solve our problems. We have a much bigger problem of we have no place here in Russia, that Russification was one big failure. So we have to change our ways. He slams the table and gets out, walks out. He made a big, big fuss, big macha, as they would say. And he goes on to travel a little bit in Western Europe, and he writes a manifesto. And he writes this manifesto while in Berlin and in German, because he couldn't write it in Russia, and he couldn't publish it in Russian. The censors would destroy it, and they'd arrest him. What is this manifesto? Auto-emancipation. Let's discuss it in some length. Auto-emancipation. He begins with a quote from Pirkei Avos. Now, for a guy who didn't know a word of Talmud, he's quoting from Pirkei Avos, okay? Im ein ani li, mi li. V'im lo achshav, eim atai. If I'm not for myself, who's going to be for me? And if not now, when? There's an urgency to the matter, urgency, because we can't wait any longer. They're killing our people. And nobody's going to help us but ourselves. See, it's like this. Wherever the Jews reside, they form a heterogeneous element that cannot be assimilated. They cannot be assimilated. He initially thought they could be. Now he's saying, I see that's not true. We cannot be assimilated. Relations between nations are adjusted by international law and treaties. The Jews lack most of the attributes which were a hallmark of a nation: common language, custom, land, government, and accredited representatives. So what he's complaining about is that the Jews, unlike all other people, they can't protect themselves in the world of international diplomacy. We don't have a state. We're not the majority anywhere. We don't have accredited representatives. Every other national group is protected by the fact that somewhere in the world they form a majority. So even where they don't form a majority, you can't push them around too much because their homeland will be concerned about it, meaning the Irish, if they're bossed around in New York, so the Irish government in Ireland will care, or the Italians, or the Poles. Whatever. Everybody has some form of homeland and a government that can look after their people in their own diaspora. But we've got nothing. We're just, you know, 20% of the population here in the Pale, or 15% of the population, and we're nowhere the majority. Nobody's looking out for us. We can't protect ourselves. Now, Jews, nations never have to deal with a Jewish nation. They must always deal with mere Jews. Critical idea. Nations don't deal with a Jewish nation. They deal with mere Jews. When does that change? So it changes, certainly with the establishment of the State of Israel, but I would argue it changes even before that. As soon as the international community recognizes Zionism as the national liberation movement of the Jews, let's say with Balfour Declaration or the League of Nations mandate, so it's no longer the Jews, it's the Jewish people, the Jewish nation. And certainly after World War II, when the Jewish agency becomes an accredited observer status at the UN, you know, when Abba Eban is speaking at the UN in Flushing Meadow in 1946-47, it says Jewish agency, Jewish on it, in an international body. So that's where he's an accredited representative. But in 1881, 1882, the Jews don't have that. Okay, so they're just people who get bossed around. Now, Jews thought to themselves...
Huh? Wasn't that like success?
It was both. There were two places. The vote happened in Lake Success. The parking lot across Mel IJ. So... Yeah. Now, Jews think that they have acquired for themselves cosmopolitan tendencies. They willfully renounce their own nationality. So here, Pinsker is saying the same thing that Hess was saying, that Jews basically want to deny themselves the possibility of a national resurgence. That we're just people, we're people who want to blend into the countries in which we live. We don't have a nationality for ourselves. Nowhere, however, did they succeed in obtaining from their fellow citizens recognitions as native-born citizens of equal rank. Meaning, despite all of our cosmopolitanism, it didn't really help. Because the Jew in France, or the Jew in Germany, or the Jew in England is still a Jew. He's not really an Englishman or a German or a Frenchman. The deracinated Jew denies the reasonableness of the need for an independent national existence. And in a sick person, the absence of desire for food and drink is a very serious symptom. So the doctor in him was saying, just as a person who is horribly ill, maybe on a deathbed, doesn't want to eat or drink, doesn't think that they're hungry or thirsty, so too a community which is nationally on the verge of death will deny the need for nationalism. Okay? And it's not always possible to cure this person of their fateful loss of appetite, meaning he's not 100% sure that we can turn this thing around and make Jews into advocates for their own national cause. Jews are like the dead walking among the living, and the fear of the Jewish ghost is handed down from generation to generation. Judeophobia is a psychic disorder. It's hereditary. Okay, now he has an interesting point. He says, to be plundered as a Jew or to be protected as a Jew is equally humiliating. Meaning, I don't want your philo-Semitism, and I don't want your anti-Semitism. I don't want you at all, you Gentile overlords. I want my own dignity, which is going to happen when I'm on my own, and not under your thumb, whether it's a benevolent one or a malevolent one. Okay. Foreigners claim hospitality, which they can repay in the same coin. The Jew can make no such return. Consequently, he can make no claim to hospitality. In other words, when I go abroad as an American, so I can be warmly welcomed somewhere because the people in that country know if they come to America, I'll return the favor. But the Jew who has no country can't return the favor. Therefore, he's expecting no favors and is going to get no favors. Next point. Like the Negroes, like women, and unlike all free peoples, the Jews must be emancipated. Critical point. that in 1881, in most countries, women didn't have the right to vote, certainly not in the United States, and not in most European countries, and not in Russia where nobody voted, okay? And like the black man, okay, who in every country outside of Africa was not given full citizenship at that point in time. There are racist laws pretty much everywhere. So you have to be emancipated. The law is not in your favor now. The law would have to be amended for you to have full rights. That's the status of the Jew. But legal emancipation is not social emancipation. Legal emancipation is often given to the Jews as a matter of the logic of the law or enlightened self-interest. But it's never the result of human feeling, meaning nobody really likes us. Even the people who give us emancipation and do it quickly do so because it would be inconsistent with their legal system for there to be an outlier who's not emancipated. But nobody really, as a matter of human feeling and sentiment, loves the Jews and wants to give them full rights. For the living, the Jew is a dead man. For the natives, he's an alien and a vagrant. For the rich, he's a beggar. For the poor, he's a millionaire, an exploiter. For the patriot, he's a man without a country. And for all classes, he's a hated rival. Meaning, whoever you are, you think the Jew is the polar opposite, and you hate his guts. We prayed for a little place anywhere to rest our weary head. We have sunk so low that we become jubilant when, as in the Occident, a small fraction of our people are put on equal footing with non-Jews. In other words, for the Jew in Russia in 1881, they think, wow! In America, the Jews are free. There are 20,000 Jews in America. No, there are 250,000 Jews in America at that point. But for the Russian Jew, oh, wow, in America, they're actually free. Unbelievable. Unfathomable. So, then he says like this. The belief in the Messiah and divine intervention was bad for the Jews. He denies Mashiach. And it says not only does he not deny Mashiach, Mashiach is a bad idea. Why is Mashiach a bad idea? Because the people came to think that they couldn't be proactive in their own salvation. The people without a fatherland forgot their fatherland. If you thought you could achieve your own salvation, then at some point when the going gets tough, you'll make an effort. If you're under the impression that for theological reasons it's not allowed, then you won't make the effort. And if you don't make the effort, you'll forget about Eretz Yisrael, which is what happens. So for all the davening of Eretz Yisrael, baloney, he would say. It doesn't matter. Nobody did anything about it. Now, in 1882, they produced a reaction which points to something other than fatalistic submission to a punishment inflicted by the hand of God, meaning there are people who no longer believe this anymore. There are acculturated Jews who don't subscribe to old-fashioned fatalistic theology, and they're willing to take some action. We must not resign ourselves to playing the role of the wandering Jew in the future. We have to use our remaining moral force to establish ourselves as a living nation. A living nation, not a dead one. Okay. Therefore, this is a direct quote, we must abandon the delusive idea that we are fulfilling by our dispersion a providential mission, a mission which no one believes in, an honorable station which we, to be frankly, would gladly resign if the odious epithet Jew would be blotted out from the memory of man. Meaning, like was said last week by Hess, except Hess said it in a watered-down fashion, Pinsker sing it more directly and absolutely, there is no concept of Or LaGoyim. There is no concept of the Jews having a mission in the world. It was made up by the Reform rabbis. It's baloney. It's not true. We're in the diaspora by accident of history. Yes, the Orthodox will believe because of our sins. We pay chatenu v'leinu me'aretzenu. For our sins we were exiled from our land. But absent the Orthodox belief, putting that aside for the moment, anyone who thinks that our presence in the diaspora was to serve some cosmic mission to bring morality to the Gentiles is basically a liar. Because no one really believes that. It's just an accident of history and we got to get out. It's a very, very secular concept. It's not an Orthodox concept. It's not a Reform concept. It's a secular concept. That we shouldn't try to explain the past as being some cosmic destiny. It just was. And now let's make it better. Okay. So, Russia would benefit, he says, from a more even distribution of the Jewish population away from its southernmost southwestern provinces. Meaning if the Jews were actually dispersed all throughout Russia and were not like a glut of people in any one spot, maybe we wouldn't have such problems and there wouldn't be horrible pogroms. thought we'd blend in a little bit, maybe. But the Russians won't listen to me. Meaning the Russian government isn't interested in really solving their Jewish problem. They're not interested. They like having a Jewish problem, and they like persecuting the Jews. Scapegoat, yeah. So Russia is too stupid, and it's not our fault. That's what he says. And he's right. So we have a surplus population living like parasites. Mass immigration to another country is not going to work out. Because eventually those countries will reject us. Is he right or is he wrong? He's right. What happens in 1917 and in 1924, the United States of America passes the Johnson-Reed Amendment and restricts immigration to a quota of 2% of the population based upon the 1890 census, which means you get almost nobody in through the doors of Ellis Island anymore. So he was right that if you try to burst into another country, they're going to dislike you like Russia, and they're going to stop the immigration. Okay. We must not dream about restoring ancient Judea. Wait a second. Isn't he a Zionist? We must not dream of restoring ancient Judea. Well, then where are you going to go? You got to get out of Russia. You can't go to any one place and be a glut of population there. But he doesn't want Judea. Where does he want? He wants somewhere. Where's somewhere? Anywhere. But anywhere that's Jewish and independent Jewish. It could be in the Holy Land, potentially. But it doesn't have to be the Holy Land. If the Holy Land doesn't satisfy our criteria for what's good for our people, then we're going to go somewhere else. So, we have to, so he says it could be that we'll go to America. But if we're going to go to America, we have to act fast, because the population of America is rapidly growing. And soon they're going to run out of room. Now, this is 1882. He sounds like Donald Trump. All right. America's going to run out of room, so we have to act fast. Where in America? The West, the far West, because there's wide open spaces over there, and maybe they'll give us a sovereign state of our own in the West. Huh?
The fiscal
pit. Yeah. But California was already a state in 1850. Okay, so the alternative is some pashalik in Asiatic Turkey, meaning he's not committed to North America, or South America necessarily. It could even be in Turkey. It could be in Asia. It could be in the vicinity of Eretz Yisrael. He doesn't really have a strong opinion one way or the other where it's going to be. But it has to satisfy the following criteria. It has to be that we could settle several million people there, and the land must be uniform and contiguous. One refuge and not multiple refuges, because if it's multiple, we'll just replicate the old problem. It has to be everybody's going to go to the same place, and it's a contiguous territory. Okay. He says, now or never. The lack of national self-respect is the enemy of our renaissance. The international question of the Jew must receive a national solution. So this is auto-emancipation. What happens as a result of Pinsker writing this work? Well, he goes back to Russia. Well, before he goes back to Russia, he goes to Vienna, and he speaks to Adolf Jelinek. And Adolf Jelinek was the preacher in the Viennese temple. So he's a moderate reform rabbi. And he asks Jelinek for support for this idea. And Jelinek says, I would have to deny my past and the last 30 years of my preaching. We are at home in Europe. We have lost all sense of Hebrew nationality. So what do I suggest for you, Pinsker? Go to spend a few weeks in an insane asylum. Meaning you're off your rocker. Get some rest, a vacation will do you good, and you'll restore your sanity. Now, Pinsker didn't arouse much excitement in the West, which was a shame, because he thought that the solution would come from the West. He did not believe that Russian Jews had leaders like Moses, or even like Yiftach. Okay? He thought Russian Jews were not capable of saving themselves, that they would need big shots from Western Jewry to save them. And by the way, ultimately, who's the big shot who saves them? Herzl. Herzl's a Hungarian/Viennese Jew who spent time in France. He's not an Easterner. So Pinsker was right in the long run that the great leaders were going to come from the West, not from the East. But in the moment, in 1882, he's not finding anybody who's interested in the job. But back in the East, Pinsker became an overnight hero. Overnight hero. Along the lines of very few others in modern Jewish history who became overnight heroes. I can only think of a handful of others, like Mendel Baylis became an overnight hero. But he's thrust into the limelight. He was just a physician from Odessa, but he's going to become a national figure. So Moshe Leib Lilienblum talks to Pinsker and says, listen, pal, We both agree that you need to have a national solution to our problem. But you're wrong about something. Any territory anywhere in the world isn't good enough. It has to be Eretz Yisrael. Now, Lillian Bloom, who grew up as a Talmud scholar, was more Jewish than Pinsker, who grew up in a secular environment. So it makes sense that it's Lillian Bloom has to convince Pinsker that it has to be Eretz Yisrael. Just as a decade and a half later, Herzl doesn't say it has to be Eretz Yisrael, but the Russian Zionists at the Congress force his hand and make it Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so Pinsker is an old and sick man. He hesitates to take the reins of the movement, but eventually he gives in and he becomes the leader of the Chibat Zion. There's a meeting in his home in Odessa on Rosh Hashanah of 1883, and the word is put out that we want to have a unity among all the Chovei Zion groups throughout Russia. Now, it's illegal. It's illegal to have a united supranational group, but they want to try it. And so they call a conference. And this conference takes place on November 6, 1884, in Katowice. Where is Katowice? Okay, so Katowice, at that time, is in Germany, but it's really Polish Jewry. So that's why it was chosen. It was chosen because it's both east and west simultaneously. And why do you need something on the border? You can't have the gathering on Tsarist territory. They won't allow it. It's going to have to be off the campus, you know, in Germany, where things are kosher. But it's got to be close enough that the representatives from the Chovei Zion societies in Russia could easily get there and attend. Because if they can't show up, then what's the point of having a conference? So, plus travel documents were not easy to obtain. You had to sneak across the border. There were three considerations. One, they wanted privacy of deliberation. If it was in Russia, Tsarist spies would be in the room, for sure. So privacy of deliberation meant it's got to be off beyond the border. Two, it's got to make a powerful impact upon world Jewry at large. Because you want the world Jewry to think this is like a congress of the parliament of the world Jewry. If it's in Russia, the Westerners won't know about it. Word won't get out. It's got to be over the border so that the Western Jews know about it. Thirdly, it has to be that they don't nail down their colors and expose their true intentions, lest all activity in Russia and the Ottoman Empire be suspended by government fiat. So it's going to be for Zionism, but you can't say it's for Zionism. It's got to be something else that camouflages the Zionism. So what camouflaged the Zionism? Officially, this gathering was to establish Mazkeret Moshe. Who's Moshe? No. Montefiore turned 100. His 100th birthday was around then. So Mazkeret Moshe was in honor of Montefiore's 100th birthday, and they said officially it was to promote agriculture, Jewish agriculture, around the world. No mention was made of a Jewish state because it was too far away. Everyone realized that's a silly talk, you can't talk about statehood now. Now, Rabbi Shmuel Moelever of Bialystok was the leading figure of the religious group there. And he said the meeting happened too soon. The time wasn't ripe yet. So the meeting was not all that productive. They decided to make headquarters for the movement in Berlin, but in reality, it was in Odessa and in Warsaw. They resolved to apply to the Russian government for permission to operate legally as a charitable society for Jewish agriculture. In the end, it turned out Montefiore wasn't interested. He was 100 and a little bit befuddled at that point, and he left them no money. So, because he left them no money, what happened to Mazkeret Moshe? They got rid of the name. It became Chibat Zion. So if there had been Kesef, it would have been called Mazkeret Moshe. But there was no Kesef, they got rid of the name. Okay. Pinsker did whatever he could to placate and to appease Moelever and the Orthodox. Because he wanted Orthodox participation. So he recognized we're not going to have a movement without the mass people who are still religious. He tried to get Jews in the West to join. And in Germany, the one figure he thought he could grab, he could chop, was Heinrich Goetz, the historian at Breslau. Because Goetz was a believer in Jewish nationalism to an extent. In his History of the Jews, he wrote about the continued national existence of our people in post-Talmudic times. But Goetz was afraid. He was afraid that Bismarck wouldn't like it if Zionism caught on. And so he sheepishly weaseled his way out of it with three letters to Pinsker saying, "I'm sorry, I support your cause, but I can't get involved." It was decided to not leave the movement in the hands of some unknown person in Berlin, because the goal was twofold. Chibat Zion as a national movement had two goals. One, to obtain the legal right to operate in Russia, which they didn't have yet. And secondly, to obtain the legal right to move to Israel, which they didn't have yet. And some random person in Berlin is not going to be able to do that. The movement had to be run out of Russia and basically out of Odessa, out of Pinsker's hometown. There were two further meetings, in Grodno in 1887 and in Vilna in 1889. And at these meetings, there was a fight between the Orthodox and the non-Orthodox. And Moylever basically was able to wrest control of the movement of Chibat Zion into proper, meaning Shomer Shabbos, hands. However, it was a Pyrrhic victory, because in 1890, in March, the government, the Russian government, finally allowed a society based out of Odessa, run by the secularists like Pinsker, to function. And the name of the society was, get this, the Society for the Support of Jewish Farmers and Artisans in Syria and Palestine. That's a mouthful. But it had to be a mouthful, because it had to camouflage what they really wanted to do, which is move Jews to Israel. So if the Syria, Palestine, farmers, artisans, you throw in a lot of verbiage, it camouflages the real intention. Now this is great news. But the truth be told, the great news came at a time when Chibat Zion was in steep decline. At its height, how many members were in all the societies all around Russia? Maybe 14,000 people, which is not much. I mean, there are millions of Jews in Russia. 14,000 is a drop in the bucket. And by 1890, 1891, they were down to about 8,000. And the money was not coming in. And it was very tedious the way they would even dispense the money to farmers in Eretz Yisrael. So the movement was not functioning properly. They tried their best, but it really they could accomplish only very small things, Chibat Zion. Now we're going to stop here. Next time we'll discuss who was breaking away from Chibat Zion, who found flaw with Zionism as it stood in 1890, and would become an outlier for the rest of his career, a leader not of practical Zionism, but of spiritual Zionism. And that is Achara Am. We'll stop.